in self-storage, if you're that full, you're not a hero. This means your rates are too low. So you might wonder, if you're buying a deal at 98% at a 4 cap, you know, where's the value creation? Well, those customers are well below market. They don't have any ancillary revenue streams like late fees, administrative fees, tenant insurance programs. So just by running it more efficiently, you can take a 4 cap deal and bring it up to a 6 in the first year. And by year 3, hopefully you're around an 8.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Today's guest is Jacob Vanderslice. He's a principal at Van West Partners. They're a Denver-based real estate investment firm, and they focus on the acquisition and management of self-storage centers and other opportunistic real estate throughout the U.S. They have a track record with over $225 million in real estate assets. And Jacob and his partner's success is driven by a commitment to delivering an expertly executed, adaptable strategy with an institutional investment approach. Welcome to the show, Jacob.
Good day, Sam. Thanks for having us on today. We appreciate it.
The pleasure's mine. Same three questions I ask everyone who comes on the show. Can you quickly tell us, where did you start? Where are you now? And how did you get there?
Well, I'll try to make it as concise as possible. I started off about 16 years ago doing single family fix and flips. And we grew that platform quite a bit in the following years. We've done over 1,000 of them all over the country. And then we got into commercial real estate in 13 and 14, doing a lot of adaptive reuse retail around Denver, basically repurposing old warehouses into multi-tenant experience-based retail concepts, you know, breweries, restaurants, gyms. Then we got into self-storage in 2015. And we looked at the asset class for a number of years, and we liked it because it's been historically recession resistant. It's performed well during downturns. And we built our first facility in Denver that we completed with a joint venture with some high net worth investors here in town. We completed that in 2017. We still own that. And we kind of grew the platform from there. We expanded into the Midwest, into the Milwaukee market. And now we own 33 facilities in the Denver Front Range, but mainly in the Midwest and Southeast. Self-storage is our main strategy the last couple of years and for the foreseeable future.
Yeah. What was it like when you guys transitioned? I mean, I know you said you guys have done basically everything, but as you finally just niched down and said, okay, self-storage, was it difficult cutting off other lines of business?
Well, we kept our other lines of business going for a long time. We actually kept our single family line of business going until about 2 years ago. And that was more of a labor of love than anything else. We weren't making a lot of money at it, just given how tough deal flow is in Denver, how much institutional capital is in the space. But we added that to our platform because one of the main mistakes we've made in our real estate careers pretty consistently is being overly transactional, which by that I mean buying, making better, and selling too often and too quickly. And we wanted a strategy that would be more of a long-term hold and more cash flow and income focused versus being just transaction focused, buy, make better, and sell. And we thought self-storage is a good vehicle for that. And that's proven to be true, especially the last couple of years. It's been a good asset class.
Yeah. I mean, what do you mean by that when you say buy, make better, and sell? I mean, we see a lot of that in multifamily, five-year business plan, things like that. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. And there's a time and a place to sell. And obviously, if you get a crazy price, it's tough not to sell. But the problem with being overly transactional is, number one, you generate a lot of tax liability. You build up cash, but you pay a lot of taxes. And the second issue with it is you have a return of capital event. The deal sells, hopefully you make good money. But then you're sitting on cash and you have to take a new round of risk and redeploy that cash into a new vehicle. That takes a lot of work. Mm-hmm. So we designed our storage funds to be more of a medium to longer term cash flow play with, of course, capital appreciation and upside, but good above market, durable recurring revenue streams.
So the problem that a lot of sponsors run into with the longer term holds is that investors typically want their capital back in a shorter time frame. They might say, okay, we want it back in 5 years. Most investors aren't okay with saying, well, we'll give it back in 20 years. How do you guys overcome that hurdle?
So our underwritten hold period is around 7 years. It could be a little bit more, it could be less, but that's certainly a challenging hurdle. The way our fund is structured, everything above and beyond preferred return goes to return investor capital accounts before anything else happens. So over time, as excess net cash flow is generated, their capital accounts are paid down incrementally every year. So the return of capital event, people are more concerned about when does my money come out and over what time period. And that return of capital event and the answer to that question is not necessarily tied to a sale. There's a lot of mechanisms at play that can return investor capital without actually a fee simple arm's length sale in the open market.
Yeah, that's interesting. I've not heard that strategy before where you have a preferred return, which is not a return of capital situation, right?
Yep.
But then anything above the preferred, you guys are treating as a return of capital.
You got it. Yeah. So if we have a 8% preferred return, $100,000 investor gets $12,000 in distributions in a given year, $8,000 of that is preferred return, and $4,000 of that reduces the capital account from 196 and kind of rinse and repeat.
Right. That's really an interesting kind of hybrid approach I've not heard before. You said there's some other ways to do that besides a fee simple transaction. Are there other methods you guys are employing?
Yeah, other ways to return capital, kind of an obvious one, is potential refinance years down the road. And that's replacing investor equity with bank debt. We're not underwriting a refinance in our modeling, and we likely won't do one anytime soon. Our debt's very competitive, at least for self-storage. It's not nearly as good as multifamily, but it's still very attractive. Another option for a liquidity event could be a recapitalization of the portfolio with a new source of equity. Give folks the option to stay in the fund at a stepped-up basis and an increased tax-free valuation, or have a liquidity event. And the most obvious of all of them, of course, is a fee simple sale of the portfolio to either, you know, large private equity or institutional capital.
Break that down for me, because I'm not sure I completely followed that event there. Obviously, you institute or you bring in new capital into the fund, but then how does an investor retain their position in the fund if they get their capital back?
Well, they would have the option to. So another shop we're familiar with, they're a big multifamily developer out of the Midwest. They have a lot of development syndications in multifamily. And they were single asset syndications with a fairly common capital base, but every deal was a standalone entity.
Sure.
They rolled all of those properties up into an income fund once they were stabilized. And they gave the limited partners in those syndications an option to either roll into the income fund at a stepped up tax-free basis or cash out. And most folks decided to roll in and kind of went along for the ride. So that's another option in terms of giving folks the option for liquidity without a third party open market fee simple sale.
Right. That's absolutely fascinating. So you guys are underwriting for a 7-year hold. Is there intentions? Because I know one of the things that maybe we can talk about today is how you can use self-storage in retirement. Like, is there intentions for getting at some point where you can hold it longer even than that?
Well, if we could create a scenario where refinance proceeds drove a substantial return of capital, if not a complete return of capital, I think the incentive to sell, if and when that happened, would be diminished. Because the fund and the investors in the fund and ourselves have largely been de-risked because our principal's back. And even though our money's back, we're still continuing to get distributions. We're still getting the tax benefits of holding real estate. So that could be a scenario where that hold period is extended. Within our documents, we didn't do a hard exit date. Say we decided to sell everything on year 5 and our PPM. We didn't do that because we didn't want to be forced to sell into an environment that's not ideal to sell into. Let's say year 5 comes, and for whatever reason, maybe cap rates have gone up, but the value of the asset base may have declined, but we're still making great distributions and creating great cash flow. We don't want to be selling into an environment that's not ideal to sell into.
Sure, absolutely. That makes a heck of a lot of sense. When it comes to self-storage, I mean, you guys branched out. You did your first, was it a ground-up build that you said you did in 2017? Was that right?
Yeah, we did a number of ground up projects here in Denver. We repositioned the multi-story office building into self-storage. Our fund strategy has been purely focused on buying existing facilities that are undermanaged and adding value through our operating platform, basically bringing below market customers up to market rates, growing occupancy and controlling expenses. We are seeing new opportunity to get back into development that we haven't seen for a couple of years. So we'll likely be doing some single asset syndication development deals, maybe starting in Q2, Q3 of 2022. But we haven't built for a while, but the deals we have built, we still own.
Maybe we'll take a little left turn here and talk about this office building to self-storage project you guys did. I mean, that's the common question right now is, will office return? What does that look like going forward? I mean, how did you guys, I guess, just talk us through that project? That sounds fascinating.
Yeah, we've done two of them. One was a bit larger and one's a bit smaller. The larger one was interesting because the structural loads were not adequate for self-storage. So we had to install what's basically carbon fiber paper mache on the load-bearing beams to structurally reinforce it up to a floor load level that would support a storage use. So as you can imagine, that was expensive and took a while, but it turned out to be a really good project. That deal was just south of downtown Denver. And the other building we did, which was kind of industrial office, we bought a building also south of downtown Denver, and we converted the upstairs into nice office space, which is where I'm sitting right now, and the ground floor to climate controlled self-storage. We live and work in a storage facility.
That's awesome. Keeps you close to the market then, I guess.
That's right. Yeah. It's kind of our showroom. If somebody wants to know what storage looks like, yeah, just come downstairs.
Come downstairs. Oh, that's hysterical. When you say that there's going to be new opportunities for ground up, what has shifted such that that is something you're now thinking about again?
Well, one of the risks in self-storage is oversupply. And when you have oversupply, you have a decline in rates and occupancy, and your deals don't perform like you thought they would. So a lot of people built around the same time, and call it 2019, in Denver and some other markets, and rates went down. And those rates have really recovered. The entire industry has had a very record-setting year in terms of occupancy growth and revenue growth. So a couple of years ago, multi-story new construction deal might have gotten $1.50 per square foot per month. And now that same deal is probably at $1.80 or maybe even $2 a foot per month.
Wow.
So as those rates have gone up in this inflationary environment and higher consumer demand environment, we're seeing it make more sense to target very difficult to entitle sites in very high barrier to entry markets where it's really tough to get city approval. It's really tough to execute on the construction side. And once you build a product type like that, that's difficult to replicate, we believe the buyer demand for something like that at stabilization will be pretty substantial because you can't make more of them. So rents have gone up and stabilized. Supply is kind of stabilized. And we think now is the time in certain parts of the country to get back into it.
It seems like you guys have a tool in your tool belt to kind of cut through all of that nonsense that everyone else doesn't want to undertake, right? Like the reason that those facilities aren't built yet and the reason they will be valuable is because it's such a pain in the neck to actually get them built.
It is. And many sites, you have to get a rezone done, which is a lengthy, expensive, risky process. You have to have a lot of runway in your contract between when you sign the contract, when you actually close. A lot of sellers don't want to do that. So they're tough to find and they're even tougher to execute, but that difficulty is what creates value.
Right. How do you guys identify those sites? And then what are some of the things early on that make you say, yes, we think we could actually do something with this or no?
Well, we look at a few things. We look at the current supply ratios in the submarket. Self-storage is very local supply sensitive in the 1, 3, and 5 mile trade radius. So national supply ratios are certainly a data point, but they're more submarket level. So we'll look at that first, and then we'll analyze the amount of new supply against the forecasted population growth that would kind of have to happen before supply becomes out of balance. And if we determine, okay, a lot of deals have to get built over the next 5 years in this submarket to have an imbalance in supply, that's probably an acquisition that we'll go after. And then beyond that, we're underwriting, obviously, the lease-up velocity once you deliver the project, the hard costs, contingencies, site work budgeting, third-party reports, or their environmental issues, zoning analysis. So there's a lot that go into it, but mainly on the front end, it's an exercise in supply today and where that supply is expected to go over the next 3 to 5 years.
Right. That's absolutely fascinating. So one of the things, Jacob, that you mentioned was the lease up of a facility. I think that's a unique nuance in this, especially when building new. How do you forecast lease up? Is that unique to each location? Or is it something we could say, hey, we know on average it takes this amount of time?
It's pretty unique to each location. In general, if you build a new facility, it's going to take you at least 18 months, maybe 2 years to move your first customer in. And then once you move your first customer in, it's probably an additional 3 years before you're getting stabilized. So when you're delivering a vacant self-storage property that's new, you price your rents very far below market to drive that occupancy up. So you're not giving away units, but you're substantially discounting units. And as you get to critical mass occupancy, you start tweaking your revenue management and increasing rates over time. So round trip on a development deal from land acquisition to stabilization, it's probably going to take you 5 years.
Wow. 5 years to where that thing becomes wildly profitable, or 5 years until it actually turns a profit?
It'll be turning a profit before then, 5 years until stabilization. Let's say you want to build these things to a 7 cap and sell them at a 5.5 cap. you will not properly achieve that 7 cap until 3 years of operations from delivery.
Got it. And what constitutes stabilized? 12 months, 24 months of consistent revenue?
Yeah, I'd say it depends on kind of where you're at in the market cycle. Right now, storage valuations, just like a lot of asset classes, are using a very short amount of history. It's prudent to use more history, like the last year. But obviously, if you go back 12 months or 18 months, there's a lot of wonky data points that hopefully will not happen again. So a lot of underwriting these days is annualizing T3 and then kind of on a look forward basis. So you might consider yourself stabilized after you've got that first kind of 3 months of stabilized net operating income.
Wow, that's fascinating. Talk to us, like, how are you guys finding opportunity nationwide? I mean, because you're doing more than just working there in the Denver market, right?
Yeah, we're in the Midwest and Southeast. Just over 70% of our deals are sourced off market through broker relationships. And sometimes when you hear off market, you think, oh, it's not really off market, it's a bad deal. Well, these are actually off market, and we've gotten some, what we believe are pretty good discounts on a few portfolio acquisitions just by having relationships. The other third of our deals are marketed, but they're often inefficiently marketed. Maybe it's a residential broker who takes it to market, or it's a guy that's not doing a good job providing financials to buyers. We had a deal that we bought in Florida a couple months ago, and the financials the seller provided were across his entire real estate portfolio. So nobody could strip out how the actual storage facility was going because it was just layered in with everything else. So we spent a lot of time helping the seller kind of separate his financials out so we get a clear picture on how the deal was going. And I think a number of the other buyers that were targeting it just didn't want to put that effort into it. And it turned out it was a good deal and we closed. So about 70-30 off market and kind of poorly marketed, shall we say.
And one of the things that you said was that you guys can value add that by bringing in your guys' marketing and management side of the business that you guys have really perfected. Is that right?
Yeah, most of our value creation on these properties, I mean, we'll implement some nominal capital improvements at closing, like new gate systems, deferred maintenance issues, seal coating the asphalt, door swaps, paint. But most of our value creation is in the operation side. And the deals that we're targeting, at least in our fund structures on the development side, but they're just very undermanaged facilities. And in many cases, they want to have a website. They might be 98% occupied. And in self-storage, if you're that full, you're not a hero. This means your rates are too low.
Right.
So you might wonder, if you're buying a deal at 98% at a 4 cap, you know, where's the value creation? Well, those customers are well below market. They don't have any ancillary revenue streams like late fees, administrative fees, tenant insurance programs. So just by running it more efficiently, you can take a 4 cap deal and bring it up to a 6 in the first year. And by year 3, hopefully you're around an 8.
Wow, that's fantastic. Jacob, I really enjoyed this today. I've learned a lot about your business, what you guys have done. It's pretty impressive to just look at all the various things that you guys are doing, from ground up development to scaling across the country and really finding out how you guys add value inside a self-storage facility, because that's pretty fascinating how that's done. Let's jump here into a final few questions. If you could help our listeners avoid just one mistake in real estate, what would it be and how would you avoid it?
Oh, I made so many mistakes in real estate. I can't begin to think of a good example off the top of my head. One mistake to avoid, which is going to sound like kind of a strange answer, is to do nothing. You can think about investing. You can think about pulling the trigger on a deal, but your greatest asset is your time. And you'll never learn if you don't go out there and do a deal. And you can't read it in a book. You can't get it in a seminar. The greatest mistake you can have is to not take action.
Yeah, that's a good one. I like that.
And one other one is, don't build a house out of shipping containers. I'll save you the effort. Just don't do it.
There's a story there, but we don't have time for it.
That's right. That's right.
There you go. Don't build a house out of shipping containers. Noted. Next question for you. When it comes to investing in the world, what's one thing you're doing right now to make the world a better place?
Well, we're implementing solar in our development deals as we get those off the ground next year. And we think that's going to be a pretty big deal in terms of energy efficiency and our carbon footprint. We're also involved with a local nonprofit called Historic Denver, does a lot of historic preservation around town. And I did Big Brothers Big Sisters for about 8 years. And my kid eventually grew up and kind of moved on and became an adult. But we make impacts as often in as many places as we possibly can. It's been tough the last couple of years with a 3 and a 2 year old and running a business. but hope to get out there a little more on the philanthropy side as my time frees up.
Hey man, if you can raise good kids, you've done a good job.
Yes, so. That's an impact right there, I guess.
Oh yeah. My gosh, absolutely. Good parents, they're hard to come by. So good for you, man. Okay, last question for you, Jacob. If our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
So then go to our website, which is vanwestpartners.com. They can email me also, Jacob, J-A-C-O-B, at vanwestpartners.com, or LinkedIn, Jacob Vanderslice.
Awesome. Jacob, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
Sam, thanks for having us on. Fly safe out there.
Hey, you too, sir.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.